morning.
In the biblical first letter of John, we hear the following. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shineth in the darkness, and the darkness comprehendeth it not. In the Quranic Surah number 2, we are told, of those who believe, he brings them out from darkness into light. As for those who disbelieve, their patrons are false deities. They bring them out of life and into darkness. For both Christians and Muslims, the pursuit of light is central to the faith, and the process by which we discern light is understood in both traditions to be the result of variously defined actions, whereby human instincts, reason, and in some cases divine revelation, are understood to be the operative mechanisms for the sorting, distinctions, perceptions of difference that are understood to be part of spiritual discernment. We must discern right action before we act at both the personal and the corporate level. And so this question of discernment is central to this symposium's mandate to explore religious perspectives on the civil life. In what follows, I will explore the lessons that can be drawn from a concrete and recent example of how one Christian community's process of discerning light shaped its response to a particular civic issue, the case of the Canadian Muslim teen detainee of Guantanamo Bay, Omar Khadr. I will begin with a story about the King's community's involvement with the Khadr case and explore the historic and denominationally shaped conditions which, I believe, made it possible and indeed necessary for this particular community to engage with the Khadr case and with Mr. Khadr himself in a context where others have not. Of course, there are other communities where equal or greater support for the Khadr case has occurred. Audrey Macklin's work at the University of Toronto comes to mind. Several Canadian reporters and media outlets have worked relentlessly for years to tell this story. And the tireless efforts of Amnesty International have been nothing short of heroic. Compared to these, the activities of the King's community are modest. I also do not want to claim that the motivating energies that I will identify for the King's community are the only set of motivations that have resulted in sustained action on this case. The scope of this paper is narrow. I will examine this particular community's motivations and how they may be explained by our culture and history. I will then examine the broader civic context into which this issue has grown locally and explore the humble practices of hospitality, meal sharing, common to the very foundations of the House of Abraham that, I aver, made possible sustained action possible. Finally, I will gesture toward a conclusion regarding the lessons that this particular experience may offer to the broader conversation about religion and public life. I will assert that that discernment finds its maturity in action, and that the act of witnessing by telling a story makes possible the patient processes of peacemaking that, in turn, make civil life possible. Illegal and immoral. Canadian and international legal authorities, as well as worldwide human rights organizations and church groups, have consistently used these words to denounce what has happened and is happening to Omar Khadr. Mr. Khadr is the Canadian youth who has been detained at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, since October of 2002, when he was 15 years old. When faced with the certainty of conviction in what many has described as a kangaroo court, he accepted a plea deal this past fall in a military proceeding at Guantanamo Bay. Remarkably, there's been very little sustained public outcry about the treatment of this Muslim Canadian youth by either the Christian churches or the Islamic mosques. In September of 2008, the students and faculty at the King's University College heard about the case from Dennis Edney, Canadian lawyer for Omar Khadr. Mr. Edney was one of a host of speakers invited to talk about invisible dignity at one of the university's semi-annual interdisciplinary studies conferences. This particular conference set out to examine how our inherent human dignity may be obscured by poverty and injustice. For a full hour, Mr. Edney held his audience spellbound by a story of the law, its transgression, and the human being trapped in the midst of these events. He spoke about the rule of law, about provisions made in international statutes for children, especially in circumstances of war, and about how all of these laws were being ignored in Omar Khadr's case. He spoke about the horrors of Guantanamo Bay, the allegations of torture and death that have haunted this U.S. prison outside of the reach of U.S. law. He spoke about Omar. He talked about an abused teenager who had quite literally been through hell. He told the stories of interrogations carried out on his 15-year-old client by a man later tried and convicted of torturing another detainee to death. He spoke of a profoundly wounded teen with a fist-sized bullet hole in his chest who was nicknamed Buckshot by the guards because of so many shrapnel wounds in his body and was made to carry heavy pails of water until these wounds wept. He talked about sleep deprivation, the petty cruelties of cold temperatures, and the prison's refusal to grant the adolescent, who was glowing blind due to the shrapnel wounds, a pair of glasses that might save his sight. He told students how, despite all of this, and in the context of years of conversations, he's never heard Omar Khadr speak an ill word about anyone. Mr. Edney is one of the very few people who have come to know Omar Khadr during these last 8 years. He's among a privileged few who are able to speak about the person in the center of the controversy, and he has done so repeatedly for years now in a number of public forums. When he told this story to the King's community, many students and faculty were deeply moved by what they heard and desired to respond. As Mr. Edney will attest, this response was not unusual. Many times his speeches are followed by expressions of concern and goodwill by his listeners. What was unusual, although certainly not unprecedented, was the degree of tenacity that the King's community maintained for the issue long after the speech had concluded and the scope of the action that ensued. Mr. Edney's speech touched off an odyssey of student learning. Immediately following the conference, faculty encouraged students to research the story fully, to gather information from as many other positions and vantage points as they were able, to ensure that their understanding of this issue was complete. They read the House of Commons proceedings. They interviewed their MPs. They researched back issues of media reports and watched television documentaries produced about the case. Once they had done all of this, the students returned, newly invigorated by their learning and desiring to communicate this with others. In November of 2008, students hosted a replicate of their interdisciplinary studies conference for the city of Edmonton. Approximately 700 Edmontonians came out to listen and learn. 1 year later, in November of 2009, students from the King's community collaborated with Amnesty International and youth from the Al-Rashid Mosque and the University of Alberta to stage an outdoor rally in the lead-up to the Supreme Court of Canada's final hearing on the case before it went to trial at the military commissions in Guantanamo. 250 came out in the very cold, damp afternoon to signal their support for Mr. Khadr's repatriation. Meanwhile, a smaller group of students, motivated by a call from the biblical passage of Matthew 25 to visit the prisoner, began a series of correspondences with Mr. Khadr by way of Mr. Edney. Most recently, in November of 2010, a small group of faculty members at the King's have volunteered to devise a tailored curriculum for Mr. Khadr's use during his final year of punitive, solitary confinement at the Guantanamo prison before his scheduled repatriation to Canada next fall, where he's scheduled to serve another full 7 years in maximum security incarceration. How does one account for this tenacity? What was it about this particular community that has allowed this issue to take root here, especially given the equally sustained opposition that this case continues to generate in other places? One could argue that the embrace of an issue concerning a Muslim youth might be less likely in a confessionally Christian environment where the identification of the other requires a specific transgression of clearly identified faith barriers. I believe that a partial answer to this question comes from the tradition out of which this community is founded and the rigorous habits for intellectual discernment that this tradition develops. The King's University College emerges from a specifically neo-Calvinist tradition of the Dutch Christian Reformed Church, or CRC. The CRC community in Canada is largely comprised of an immigrant community of the Dutch diaspora. So it may be important to acknowledge that the identification with the other that occurred in the Cotter case may be owing to the intuitive compassion extended from one immigrant community to another. My hunch is, however, that the explanation runs much deeper than this. As we will hear several of my colleagues argue over the next day or so, the Dutch CRC tradition roots itself in a specifically Kuiperian understanding of sphere sovereignty that results in a simultaneous respect for creational diversity and appreciation for the many ways in which Christ's claim over all of creation must be worked out through a variety of functions, each of which is uniquely gifted for the task placed before it. Rather than build church-run schools, as many other Christian denominations have done over the course of Alberta's history, the Christian Reformed Church members who founded the King's sought to build a non-denominational Christian liberal arts school that would fully integrate the Christian faith with the pursuit of disciplinary learning. The community's philosophical commitment to sovereign spheres made church control of the university unpalatable. And the university's understanding of its mandate to be fully and self-consciously a Christian enterprise with responsibilities for the redemptive work of Christ in the world ensured the community's commitment to a deep engagement with the intellectual work from a distinctly Christian perspective and its understanding of the need to blend theory and praxis. It is out of this understanding about the theory and practice that the interdisciplinary studies conferences themselves are born. These conferences are a tangible working out of the commitment to ensure that the redeeming work of the university does not end at the institution's doors, but is instead made serviceable to the community beyond our walls. In these conferences, students are challenged to see the fundamental connections between the worldview assumptions of faith, that is, our final answers, so to speak, to the questions that animate our humanity, and the theorizing that we do in each of the disciplines. These conferences also demonstrate to students how the theorizing work accomplished in each discipline, in turn, works together to shape our understanding of real-world issues and increases our capacity to discern right action. In the very first convocation address delivered at the King's College, as it was in 1979, Richard J. Mao, professor of philosophy from Calvin College, a sister institution in the Christian Reformed tradition, underscored this connection between theory and praxis in clear terms. Listen to him when he says, "The King's College must be itself an agent for the kingdom. It must engage in activities which extend the visible rule of Christ, carrying the influence of that rule into the larger human society. The passive and active dimensions of this task are complementary. As persons who have been nurtured by Christ, we must in turn become sources of nurture in the world. As those who have been served by him, we must in turn become servants of others, especially of those who are oppressed. As those who have been shaped by the kingly rule of Jesus, we must in turn become shapers of culture in accordance with the demands of the gospel. As those who have been acted upon by his kingdom, we in turn must be agents of that kingdom." End quote. It's a rousing vision, worked with a compelling call to action. Its animating energies, I believe, resonate today in the interdisciplinary conferences that first introduced Omar Khadr's plight to this community, and in the seemingly self-evident understanding that knowledge of the case gained during the conference and afterward came with a concomitant responsibility to do something about it. But doing something about an issue as stigmatized and politically controversial as the Cotter case is, can be difficult. It often takes more than ordinary resolve to get involved and stay involved. From the moment that students and faculty began speaking out on the issue, they were met with questions and on many occasions active resistance from those who felt the community's impulse toward mercy was misguided. I need to say here that some of those oppositional voices came from within the CRC community. So whatever claims I make here about the denominationally specific origins of that animating energy for the case must be qualified by this admission. I think it is true, however, that the deep Protestant roots of Reformed theology and its reverence for learning help to make it possible for both faculty and students to persevere in the face of opposition. As we will hear my colleague Mike Dumour argue, the Kuyperian roots of the Christian Reformed tradition work themselves out in a deeply intellectual understanding of this process of discernment. The parsing, separating, classification, sorting of diversity that is the work of an intellectual community is bolstered at the King's with the cultural understanding born out of these Protestant roots that all matters of importance are to be dealt with fully. As a result, students and faculty were well prepared to argue carefully and with precision about many aspects of the case when challenged to do so. The original empathy created by Mr. Edney's story was fortified and substantiated by a rigorous intellectual engagement with the issue that emerged quite naturally from the culture at the King's. Further, a specifically Kuyperian awareness that political opinions and ideas are not religiously neutral also served to alert the community to lines of argument that betrayed its proponents' prior commitment to ideologies and political discourses that made the seemingly obvious truth of the gospel message incomprehensible to them. Out of this awareness came, I believe, the courage to persist when the sharing of knowledge was fruitful, and the wisdom to desist when fundamental worldview conflicts made the possibility of agreement slim. While the founding tradition at the King's is firmly rooted in the CRC Church, it is also true that many of the faculty and students who have embodied concern for Omar Khadr do not locate themselves in this denominational camp, or even within the Christian Church. Several of the King's students who have been most actively involved in this issue are themselves Muslim. It's important to acknowledge, therefore, that whatever I'm claiming here is the animating energy that emerged from the CRC-informed culture at King's was also worked through individuals who have grown up in and continue their faith practices with very different traditions. Within the King's, the richness and diversity of our Christian faith traditions were nurtured and sustained by a practice of morning prayer. For a lengthy period of time following the conference, a 9 a.m. meeting took place in the prayer room to petition specifically for Omar Khadr and for others whose plights were made known to us. These prayer sessions were among my favorite memories from the days and weeks that followed that conference in 2008. The sessions were shaped by who showed up and whatever traditions were habitual for these folk. Some mornings when I or my colleague Steve Martin was first to arrive, the prayers were quite structured and liturgically governed. Other times they were popcorn prayers that arose spontaneously from the hearts of those who gathered. This practice in all of its forms did two critically important things. It allowed our diverse community of faith to anchor itself in the narrative of the gospel common to us all, and to infuse our imaginations with the clear reminder that the world in which the prisoners are granted justice, where governance seeks restoration and renewal of all things, is indeed the real world. These prayer sessions also provided an intimate venue for sharing the quiet desires and concerns of individual hearts. We came to know one another more fully and to understand which way the Spirit might be leading us through communal sharing of wisdom. As student activity led the King's community off campus and into working relationships with other groups, the processes for discernment that had hitherto been largely centered in an academic and rational understanding of the issues and the guiding philosophical Christian commitments for service needed to expand and soften to take up the new challenges for dealing with people who did not share this background. The intuition, instinctual understanding, and testing of spirits that went on and still goes on among the larger groups who continue to advocate for Mr. Cotter is a far more personal and intimate energy to track. In this section of my paper, I will need to speak more personally about what I think went on in the processes of discernment, because while I can point to concrete physical practices that actually occurred and which no doubt played a significant role in allowing the necessary trust and understanding to build, the manner in which I personally understand how the confidence that comes from knowing the people you work with was developed in the Cotter case has more in common with the Catholic Ignatian processes of discernment that I grew up with than it does with the more rational and intellectual versions I have come to admire and participate in the neo-Calvinist tradition. In a chapter entitled A Way to Clarify Your Values, a Jesuit father named David L. Fleming introduces his readers to an Ignatian practice and prayer called the Two Standards Meditation. Ignatius encourages readers to imagine a battlefield wherein Christ is matched with Lucifer. Summoning the full pageantry of a medieval challenge, one is encouraged to see the demeanor of Christ as he carries out his standard or flag onto the battlefield and to compare it with the raw display of power exhibited by the satanic camp. In using the name Lucifer, Ignatius reminds the faithful of Satan's origin as an angel of light, and hence he underscores the deceptive nature of evil. All that looks like light may not be light. The process of clarifying values is, therefore, far more complex when that which is associated with evil can masquerade as light. In the end, what Ignatius is advocating here shares an awful lot with the Protestant and specifically neo-Calvinist habit of mind that seeks to explore the foundational assumptions that undergird any action. But the manner and approach is far more sensed than thought, far more readily imagined than understood. Fleming argues that the Ignatian practice of discernment asks that one engage imaginatively in an experience of, quote, the contrasting values that each leader employs in the struggle for the hearts and minds of human beings. The object is to emerge from the exercise with a renewed capacity to value the meekness, the invitational, non-violent, non-coercive strategies employed by Christ, and a corresponding distrust for the raw displays of worldly power associated with Luciferian forces. As Ignatius makes clear, Lucifer's tactics often appeal to our human nature and our rational processes. They may very well look like the light of a winning strategy. The active engagement of the imaginative realm helps to bolster trust in the power of Christ, which looks to all the world like weakness. At the risk of melodrama, I will say that in some instances, our community's adventures off campus did sometimes feel a little like entering a battlefield. The stakes were high. In several instances, national media were standing by to record whatever was said, and once the recording devices were on, there was no scope for a retraction or even a shaping of the outcome in the editing process. On several occasions, Edmonton police were brought to campus to deal with threatening letters sent to the King's community. Even personal conversations could occasionally feel risky. I know of one story where a dinner among long-standing acquaintances was drawn to an abrupt close when a favorable reading of the Cotter issue was raised by the host and several guests walked out of the house in protest. Who can you trust? Where can you build alliances? As the movement extended beyond our doors, these questions became pressing. The answers to these questions about trust are murky and deeply personal. The answers, rather than theorize any more about them, let me share with you a paradigmatic example of how rich friendship and trust developed among those who did not share a specific tradition. I met Seema at the Islamic Social Services annual fundraising dinner in October of 2008. My husband and I attended the event with Mr. and Mrs. Edney. Mr. Edney was the invited speaker, and the topic, of course, was Omar. At the conclusion of the dinner, a woman approached and introduced herself. She expressed interest in the Cotter case and asked if we might meet to discuss the matter further. I agreed, and sometime later we found ourselves seated across a table from one another, eating fabulous Middle Eastern food and sharing stories. We sat for hours, and as I recall the memory, I am impressed by the manner in which the Ignatian practice of the two standards serves as a metaphor for the growing sense of comfort and trust that emerged from that shared meal. Sima is the embodiment of quiet patience, gentleness, and calm. Her whole demeanor and approach signaled peace. I liked her very much, and I sensed that I could trust her. Before too long, Sima invited me to lunch a second time. But on this occasion, she brought along her friends from the Al-Rashid Mosque. I was introduced to Tonya, Beth, Fadila, and Nazreen at the same restaurant, and this time we stayed so long, the proprietors had to ask us to leave. The conversations were vivid and often personal, and at the outset, they had absolutely nothing to do with Omar Khadr. We were sharing a meal and getting to know one another's stories. We were building a foundation for friendship, and the common traditions of the House of Abraham were abundantly apparent in the hospitality that was offered, in the bread that was broken. As the ladies from the mosque and the community at the King's began to work together, we took these good practices into our encounters with other groups. We took time to get to know one another and the new people we added to our mix, sharing planning lunches with the local field worker from Amnesty International and passing donuts and coffee around a planning table at the mosque with community groups who generously offered their time and energies to help with the students' public events. Several years later, the group of women who first met through Sima continue to break bread with one another, and these dinners have also led to a second good practice that has, at least from my point of view, sustained and deepened the affection and trust that has grown among us. We formed a book club, the People of the Book Club. Although a new baby for Tonya has led to a recent hiatus in our reading activities, we intend to continue our good practice of reading books that helps to build understanding and appreciation for one another's faith traditions. The environment which has allowed the injustices of the Cotter case to occur desperately needs, we feel, the kind of knowledge and understanding that is born of a more formal cultural exchange. The book club is two measures, social occasion, we always share a meal, and one part book learning, but the practice itself has been, at least for me, both enriching and sustaining. In what has preceded here, I've related a very particular story, and it falls to me in the last moments to see if I can draw out of this particular experience a set of lessons applicable to civil life more generally. I believe that the King's engagement with the Cotter case has nurtured an understanding about faith and civil life that links the King's actions to a broader Christian orthodoxy and to the core tenets of Islam. Specifically, through the experiences related to this particular issue, the community at the King's has come to understand that discernment finds its maturity in action, and that the act of witnessing by telling someone else's story helps to shape the patient processes of peacemaking that, in turn, make civil life possible. Over the last several years, the community at the King's has learned that loving one's neighbor means that you have to do something, but it has also learned the limitations of that doing. The Cotter issue runs directly into the heart of political ideologies and the dominion owned by fear. This community learned quickly that a combative stance, any desire to dispute one's opponent into submission by the sheer power of rational disputation, would be lost in this venue. The call was to witness, and the task has been to tell the story repeatedly, patiently. Only then might those with ears to hear listen. Only then might those with eyes learn to see this case in a new light. At the same time, the community here has, I believe, come to a new appreciation of the power of a story and a renewed appreciation of how the willingness to tell another's can make us witnesses for the truth. It has also bolstered our commitment to patience with one another and with those who protest against our advocacy. Patience creates the space for true submission to the one true God, the Holy One, to act according to His will. While our processes of discernment culminate in a commitment to walk out the implications of our knowing. We have learned to resist the temptation to covet control of the outcome of our actions. Sometimes the fruits of our endeavors have been positive. Other times, our heartfelt actions have come to nothing. Media interviews do not always go as planned. People do not always follow through as they promised they might. Supporters sometimes withdraw their funds. Public opinion is occasionally swayed by circumstances well beyond our control. In an environment where fear is allowed to dominate the agenda and where those in power have set their faces against a fair assessment of fact, what remains often feels like fool's work. Prayer, breaking bread, sharing stories, witnessing. Yet for those who desire submission to God, this is the work. This is the call common to all branches of the house of Abraham. As theologian John Howard Yoder makes clear in much of his writing, the alternative to this patient and painstaking work is the form of Constantinian Christianity, which is anathema to the gospel. Conversion by force, consensus formed by the blade of a sword. Those who live by the sword die by the sword, so scripture tells us. Out of discernment comes a responsibility to act wisely, but what comes of that action is in God's hands. By God's grace, we participate in history, but we do not control it. He does. In the acceptance of that reality comes the opportunity for peace. The experience of walking with Omar Khadr has taught us about patience for one another, and specifically about the patience required to love one another through the twin temptations that have beset so many of our brethren and allowed this injustice to continue. The temptation to divorce one's faith from one's civil life, the temptation to narrow one's interpretation of holy text so as to exclude the other. The King's experience with the Omar Khadr case has been one in which we have all been challenged to root our understanding of right action in our own faith tradition and to use this understanding to discern light in the other. The blessings of this community's CRC roots created the opportunity for this journey. Out of this tradition comes both the rigors of rational, intellectual discernment and the commitment to act on our learning to allow Christ's transforming work to be felt in all of culture. The broad tenets of Christian orthodoxy worked out in the humble practices of prayer, breaking bread, telling stories, practices which I note are shared features of all of, branches of our House of Abraham, have allowed this community to discern light in others and to forge friendships that have extended the capacity for action beyond these doors. The activities of the last several years have also come with their own gifts, especially the lesson that all discernment finds maturity in action, but that action must serve as witness without intent to control or orchestrate the outcome. The journey for Omar is far from over, and inshallah, God willing, the King's community engagement with Omar Khadr's plight will continue in the years ahead. May the lessons learned thus far help to sustain the rest of our journey. Thank you. Thank you.